welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
Yeah, let's get ready to rumble here in the bunker. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker in north central Indiana on another beautiful day. If it would stay this way all year round, I would be very happy. It's April the 25th, 2016. The year of Odin. You're right. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your do-re-mi, baby, and your... Yeah, any other of your letters, or if you want me to send a letter to a prisoner and want me to do it, I'll do it. Just send it to me. But you bet I'm going to read it before I send it, because I know how some of you guys are. Yeah, you get me in a lot of trouble. And if you haven't gotten your donation in for April, you're pretty late there, so get her in there. Yeah. Well, I see the Hollywood Klan and the Hollywood Nazis got together, or did they, down in... Georgia, Stone Mountain this last weekend. I sent you out a bunch of stuff on it. I'm not going to talk much about it because it's the same old stuff. Same old stuff. FBI guys all over the place. Police over there to make sure that the racial people, the racialists, didn't beat up on the leftist progressives or whatever you want to call them. Couple of guys got arrested, I guess. But I guess it was on the other side. I don't know. Well, anyhow, it's done and over so they can put all that money in their gas tank and drive way to hell home. You know my opinion on this kind of stuff. I used to love it way back. Yeah, till I got educated. Yeah. I'm not going to make myself a target unless I have to. You know, it's a wonder this country lasted as long as it has. It's absolutely amazing, considering the fact that we were overrun with religious fanatics from the very beginning. Yeah, we're worried about the English and the Spanish and the Russians and all that. That's not nearly as dangerous as all the religious nonsense and Christ insanity that came over here and developed a lot of this country. So the virus was from early on the most dangerous virus of all, only second to greed. I was out in my garage yesterday and I was cleaning out things. I got to get rid of a hell of a lot of junk. Or as George Carlin says, stuff. My mother was a genealogist, and she researched all this shit from around the world, and all this stuff, and who went where, and what happened, and it was sort of interesting, that stuff, but not that interesting. Well, anyhow, in her stuff, I still got some of her stuff. There was an article here about the Shakers. Now, you've heard of whacked out religions, of course. Well, this was another whacked out religion. I'm going to read this article to you because you got to think about this. This is what the virus that crept into our race has been screwing us up ever since, because once that virus gets going, it gets into everything. It gets into, of course, the churches. It gets into the government, it gets into economy, banking, everything, gets into your attitude towards war and just about everything else. This article was about they were restoring an old religious settlement down in Kentucky, which that's what some of these people do when they don't have a life. Okay, here's the article. Because the Shakers believed in complete celibacy, you got that? They are now extinct. That's how insane people can get. But on the gently rolling hills of the bluegrass country of central Kentucky, what may have been the largest Shaker community anywhere is being restored. Oh yeah, bring it back. Bring back celibacy. See how that works out for you. Pleasant Hill, better known as Shaker Town, was the home of 900 or 500 Shakers around 1820. But by 1925, because of their belief in celibacy, the last Shaker had died. That's the same as developing a whole city out in the desert for homosexuals. Of course, now they're doing it by other means, but anyhow. The official name of the Shaker Church was the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing. Didn't say coming, said appearing. It was also known as the Millennial Church, and some of the leaders preferred the name Aletheans from the Greek word for truth, for they considered themselves children of the truth, don't they all? It all began in England in 1747 when a splinter... You know, it's amazing how superior races can go off the rails on different things. Yeah. In 1747, when a splinter group led by Jane and James Wardley broke away from the Quaker Church, another wacko church. Not that everything they did was wacko, but the concept. Ann Lee, daughter of a blacksmith, eventually took over leadership of the movement and became known as Mother Ann. Is that like Church Lady on Saturday Night Live? While preaching in Manchester, she was convicted of disturbing the peace and thrown in jail. I think those people used to shake and roll around on the ground or something, which would be disturbing the peace. There she said Christ came to her, see, and became part of her spirit. I keep asking all these people that say they talk to Christ and Christ come to them and all that stuff. Invite me over when all this happens. I want to see it. I want to hear it. I want to touch it. I want to put my finger in that wound on the side there, like Doubting Thomas, because my name is Thomas. Persecution coupled with the revelation Mother Ann said came to her resulted in a sect moving to America. Boy, that's pretty good. She got that kind of influence. And, I'm the leader. Let's get on the boat and go to America. The members settled near Albany, New York. Pacifism became a central doctrine of the religion, and Shakers were harassed when they refused to support the colonial cause during the Revolution. Well, I have sympathy with pacifism because most wars are a bunch of bullshit. And so I would tend to agree more with pacifism than warfarism. In 1787, a general religious revival in the New World ennobled the Shakers to win new converts, which, because of the practice of celibacy... Well, anyhow, there's a bit torn off the edge of the paper here, so I can't tell you what that was. They considered it less desirable than a celibate state. As their numbers grew through conversation or conversions, so also was their doctrine formulated. Their religious services included dancing that made them appear to be shaking, and thus they attained their popular nickname, Little Richard and his five guitar players. No. Well, anyhow, at the same time the Baptists were preaching it was a sin to dance. These guys were shaking it up. That may be where rock and roll came from. I don't know. Their official name, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, was based on their unique view of Jesus Christ. Don't they all? Shakers believe that God is both male and female. Woo. Morphodite? What do they call them? Morphodite, I think. And that the male aspect of God appeared on earth in the form of Jesus. Mother Anne, they believed, was the female form of Christ, and her appearance on the earth was the second coming of Christ. Well, that's this Mother Anne gal. She must have been one hot babe. Mother Anne traveled throughout the colonies, gaining hundreds of converts. I don't know how she could get converts. I guess it's because they allowed them to dance. But the Shakers, although they were gentle people who were friendly with members of other religious sects, cults found it impossible to integrate completely into societies with which they had so much basic disagreement. Thus, it was developed and was necessary for them to develop completely self-sufficient communities. Well, that's good. That's a good thing. Right on. In the early 1800s, three residents of Mercer County, Kentucky were converted. One of them was Elisha Thomas. Thomas gave a 140-acre farm to the sect. A large frame building was constructed on the farm to house the members, with women and men living on alternate floors of this big building. No hanky-pank. No, no, no. We're celibate. Eventually, 21 buildings, including a sawmill, a gristmill, were built. Today, 10 of those buildings have been restored, and all of them are expected to be restored in a few years. This article was written in 1973. Restoration is made relatively easy because the Shakers were industrious. That's good. Expert craftsmen, that's good, who constructed everything from a lasting, excellent quality that has withstood the ravages of time. Eventually, the 140-acre farm was increased to 4,300-acre plantation by the preachers shaking down the new people that came into the church. Give us your land. Give us your house. Give me your wife. Wait a minute. Including a warehouse and war facilities on the Kentucky River. I never heard of the Kentucky River. Well, I'm going to have to look it up on a map. Many Shakers were well-educated and talented. That's good. They were the first to sell seed commercially, and they did extensive horticultural research. They are believed to be the first people to construct a central waterworks west of the Allegheny. By raising silkworms, they made silk industry prosper in Kentucky. And a single acre of their mulberry trees produced up to 600 pounds of raw silk. Cool. Their shorthorn cattle brooms and preserves were well known throughout the Southeast for their excellent quality. Micah Burnett, working with skilled stonecutters, brick masons, and wood carvers, developed a Georgia Shaker architectural style that characterizes some of the finest examples of 19th century American construction. Well, that's good. Well, they weren't having sex. They had to have something to do. The outbreak of the Civil War spelled disaster for Pleasant Hill. Another whacked-out deal, the Civil War. Although the Shakers were neutral in the war, their Kentucky community was located on the main turnpike used by armies from both sides. Hence, they lost large stores of food, grain, livestock, and heavy farm wagons to the troops. Two whacked-out outfits. One warfare and one religious fanaticism. The ravages of the war and the practice of celibacy resulted in a steady decline of the sect. Duh. In 1923, the last of the Pleasant Hill Shakers, Sister Mary Settles, died. But the memory of their unique religious beliefs lives on in the restored Pleasant Hill, where lodging and meals in the original buildings are available to the historically minded tourist. The settlement is on, in case you want to see it, if it's still there. This was written in 73. And if they haven't had sex since then, they're gone again. The settlement is on U.S. Route 68, 7 miles northeast of Harrodsburg and 24 miles southwest of Lexington, Kentucky. So there you go. That's your Christian virus lesson for today. Now just think, there were hundreds of sects roaming this country, trying to convert everybody to whatever, even trying to convert the Indians, the so-called Indians. They never really got that done too well. And I don't blame the Indians. I think a Christian preacher come down to knock on my wigwam, I'd have tomahawked him right in the forehead. Yeah. Well, here's a note from one of our good buddies. T.T., thank you for using some of my articles I send you on the radio show. It's good to know what I do is worthwhile. Here is another. While I'm not thrilled with the messengers, what they say in this... Whoop, tip my mic over. What they say in this piece of food is food for thought. And that's Brass Check. They put out some pretty good stuff. I don't agree with them all the time, that's for sure. But they do dig around and get some pretty good stuff. I have been noticing some of the symptoms of chemtrail flu in myself. We're getting heavily sprayed here in Austin, and I really believe this is not so covert program to get rid of certain segments of society, namely Social Security recipients, blacks, and other types of elite considered undesirable. What the elite consider undesirable. Maybe you could address the chemtrails a little more from time to time. And that's from Austin. Well, I would. It's been pretty much said it's not good for us. They've been able to gather this, aluminum powder or something they're dumping on us. So obviously, along with a whole lot of other shit they're putting on us in the food and so forth, and in the water. It's definitely not good for us, but what are you going to do? I remember when Dennis Mahan was around, he talked to a guy down at Air Force Base in Ohio. I forget the name of it. And the guy crawled into the plane down there, and he found these tanks and these reservoir of whatever they're spraying on us in there. So definitely they're doing it as much different than regular trails. So, but who's going to do anything? Everybody complained. People have done a hell of a lot of complaining, but it don't pay to anymore, seems to complain to the government about anything. They're just going to do what they want to do, and that's it. It's a dictatorship. They call it democracy. Democracy bullshit. Did the prez call you this morning and ask you what you thought about sending another 300 or 400 troops over to the Middle East? Or did he ever call you on the phone and ask whether you wanted him to send those B-52s over there to the Middle East, a whole bunch of them? Well, no, that's, in other words, you don't live in a democracy. Number one, democracies are impossible. They can't last very long, if they last at all. We had a sort of a form of, what was it? I can't even remember it anymore. But anyhow, it's all bullshit. Nobody's going to do anything about the chemtrails. Why does it do any good to talk about the chemtrails if they're not going to do anything about it, or the people aren't going to demand with force that they do something? I don't see anything ever happening without violence. People say, God damn, Metzger, you're promoting violence. Well, I don't really want to promote violence, but what the hell? Nothing ever changes. And people gripe and they march and they do this and they have rallies and all that stuff, and nothing changes. So what are you going to do? You either got to shit or get off the pot, man. I don't know. But don't expect me to lead the parade. Don't. Not right now. Well, there's plenty of young guys and young people that could do something, but it takes a lot of people. And it takes a lot of planning and all that kind of stuff. And I just don't see it happening. Same way with global warming. They're not going to do anything. But it may open up a new era of evolution as people start dying off from whatever. No water or too much heat, whatever it might be. So anyhow, I'm with you, man. I've been bitching about these chemtrails for 20 years, way back when it first started. And one of the reasons nothing ever happens is because nobody gives a shit about anything. They don't care. I mean, you know, maybe 5%, if we're lucky. Maybe 1% care about anything. And we want to change it? Well, give me the plan, baby. Give me the plan. I don't see any logical plan at this moment. I know one of these days something's going to happen, because we're all going to turn into the Walking Dead. You know that show? Where we start walking around and chomping people's necks. I think that might work. Yeah. Yeah, they say they're going to put that picture of that Harriet Tubman on a $20 bill someday. I don't know. But from what I hear from the Federal Reserve, they're pissed off because there is going to be a miserable thing to try to use it and try to issue it, because it's too quick, too much, you know. But don't worry about Tubman on the $20 bill, because that $20 bill, you can probably use it in a few years to paper your walls with. That'll be funny. That'll be funny. The Negress on the $20 bill. Actually, it's a joke. It is a sick joke. But worse is better. Don't worry about it. As long as it'll spend, I guess that's okay. But making a hero out of her Underground Railroad, we may need an Underground Railroad pretty soon, too, for white people. Yeah, fleeing to northern Canada or something. Boy, oh boy, if some people didn't have bad luck, they wouldn't have any luck at all. Here's an article I just picked up off the Jewish side of the fence. In 1933, what if you were Jewish, your family name was Hitler, and you were living in the heart of Brooklyn? What would life be like for you and your two young children? Back in June of that year, this magazine ran a story on the Hitler family living in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, and the struggles that members of this Jewish family were facing because of their last name. Can't understand that. Well, let's see what... At that time, according to Rose Hitler, there were more than 30 Jewish families living in New York area with the surname Hitler. The story is among 250,000 articles that are available online. Well... The guiding principle of our reporting in 1933 remained true today. Well, the guy's pushing his own newspaper here. But anyhow, that's an interesting thing there. If you were living in Jewish Brooklyn and your name was Hitler. Wow. Well, let's see if Hillary Clinton's honest. Yuck, yuck, yuck. This is a pretty good article.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has offered a curious defense of Hillary Clinton's honesty, refuting the public's widespread view that she is a liar by narrowly defining what it means to be honest and arguing that she is less dishonest than she is a calculating and corner-cutting politician. Kristof writes, "As we head toward the general election showdown, by all means denounce Hillary Clinton's judgment and policy positions, but let's focus on the real issues. She's not a saint but a politician, and to me this notion that she's fundamentally dishonest is a bogus narrative." Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Kristof cites, for instance, that half of her campaign statements, as evaluated by PolitiFact, were rated either true or mostly true, comparable to how the group assessed statements by Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Ted Cruz and much better than Donald Trump's 22%. Leaving aside the conventional wisdom bias of this mainstream media organization, Kristof does seem to have a point. In a narrow definition of honesty, former Secretary of State Clinton may be truthful or kind of truthful half the time. But Kristof misses the larger point that the American people are making when 56% of them rate her negatively and many call crooked and dishonest. They seem to be commenting on her lack of authenticity and perhaps her resistance to sincerely acknowledging major errors in judgment. She only grudgingly apologized for her pro-Iraq war vote and still insists that her bloody regime change scheme for Libya was a good idea, even as the once prosperous North African nation slides into anarchy and deprivation with the chief beneficiary the head choppers of the Islamic State. A Nixonian quality. Many Americans sense that there is a Nixonian quality to Hillary Clinton, her excessive secrecy, her defensiveness, her rigidity, her unwillingness to acknowledge or learn from mistakes. Even when she is forced into admitting a mistake, such as her violation of State Department rules when she maintained a private email server for official correspondence, she acts as if she's just apologizing to close off further debate or examination. As with Richard Nixon, there's a feeling that Clinton's apologies and rationales are selfing, not forthcoming. Yet, while it's true that Nixon was a deceitful character, his most famous lie being when he declared, "I am not a crook," I would argue that he had some clear advantages over Clinton as president. He was a much more strategic thinker than she is and sometimes went against the grain of expectations as encapsulated in the phrase "Nixon goes to China," meaning that Nixon could open up to communist China precisely because he was viewed as such a hardliner who would never do such a thing but who finally judged that the move was in America's interests. While it's impossible to say whether Clinton would seize unexpected openings as president, she showed none of that creativity, subtlety, and courage as Secretary of State. She marched down a straightforward neocon line, doing precisely what Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wanted in the Middle East. Clinton tried to sabotage President Barack Obama's diplomatic outreach to Iran and favored military solutions to Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. She also followed a rightist approach in backing the 2009 coup in Honduras that ousted an elected progressive president who had offended some of the Honduran oligarchs and outside corporate interests. Lack of self-criticism. In addition, Clinton appears to have learned nothing from her support for the catastrophic Iraq war and has argued against conflating her Iraq decision with her Libya decision. But that suggests that she is incapable of learning a lesson from one mistake and applying it to a similar situation, an almost disqualifying characteristic for someone who hopes to become president. Being a successful president requires extracting painful lessons from one mistake and making sure you don't make the same mistake again. But Clinton's personal arrogance or defensiveness, it's hard to figure out which is dominant, prevents her from that sort of self-criticism. Indeed, her ritualistic, and politically timed, apology for her Iraq War vote in 2006 came across less as an honest recognition that she had done something horribly wrong than that she had to say something to appease a furious Democratic electorate as she mounted her first run for president against anti-Iraq War candidate Obama. Gates' duty. After losing to Obama and becoming his Secretary of State, she privately hedged her Iraq War apology by saying privately that she thought that President George W. Bush's surge in Iraq was successful and admitting that she had only opposed it in 2007 for political reasons, according to former Defense Secretary Robert Gates in his memoir, Duty. On October 26, 2009, as Gates a holdover from the Bush administration and Clinton joined forces to pressure Obama into approving a similar search for Afghanistan, Gates recalled a meeting in which Clinton made what he regarded as a stunning admission, writing, "The exchange that followed was remarkable. In strongly supporting the surge in Afghanistan, Hillary told the president that her opposition to the surge in Iraq had been political because she was facing him in the Iowa primary in 2008. She went on to say, the Iraq surge worked. The president conceded vaguely that opposition to the Iraq surge had been political. To hear the two of them making these admissions, and in front of me, was as surprising as it was dismaying." Obama's aides disputed Gates's suggestion that the president indicated that his opposition to the Iraq surge was political, noting that he had always opposed the Iraq War. The Clinton team has not challenged Gates's account. But the exchange, as recounted by Gates, indicates that Clinton not only let her political needs dictate her position on an important national security issue, but that she accepts as true the superficial conventional wisdom about the successful surge in Iraq, which claimed the lives of about 1,000 American soldiers and a much larger number of Iraqis but failed its principal mission of buying time for the Iraqis to resolve their sectarian differences. So, when one considers Hillary Clinton's honesty, more should be in play than simply whether she accurately describes her policy positions half the time. Honesty, as most people would perceive it, relates to a person's fundamental integrity, strength of character, readiness to acknowledge mistakes and ability to learn from them. On that measure, the American people seem to have sized up Hillary Clinton pretty well.
But the American people worship power. Like people around the world worship power. And as long as you worship power, you're going to have these kind of people in government. And that means probably forever. One announcement I've got for you, boys and girls. Let's see, tomorrow's Tuesday. Tuesday, Wednesday, and possibly Thursday, you'll be getting an archive radio show presented by the webmaster. I'm going to have some work done here in the bunker, and at that time I don't want to be doing a show while the work is being done. I'm installing some new cells here for wayward Jews that give us trouble. Jerry the Jew is going to have to be moved out of the bunker and into other temporary housing until we get these new cells installed here, so bear with us. Well, here's a letter from a POW. I'm not going to give you the names because I think that might not be good for the POWs. Dear Tom, hope all is going good for you. It's been a while since I wrote you last. Thank you so very much for the 7 rare articles on the Ukraine, the Crimean Peninsula, and Russia. Many prisoners here have read it and thanked me for helping educate them on the truth in this geopolitical controversy. I want to thank you again for ordering the book March of the Titans, The History of the White Race. As I write this letter, it has not come yet here. Well, I had to inform him that for some reason they didn't ship it. And I guess they say, oh, that's content that's going to cause a prison riot. We have issues with the mail delivery at our prison mailroom, or the Brewston. Tom, this BOP prison is by far the worst one out of the 3 I've been dieseled to. Every month, at least 75 illegal aliens, mestizos, come to this prison, and about 50 or 60 white non-sex offender inmates are shipped out. All you hear around here is loud Spanish being spoken or Negroes yelling, screaming jive and rap talk. This 1,500-man prison is now about 400 mestizos, 600 blacks, and 300 white child molesters, child porn producers, and so forth. So only about 200 or so sexually normal white prisoners. It may have been a blessing that David Lane died in 2007 and never had to endure this mental torture. When I was at USP McCreary, we only had about 150 to 175 mestizos. I believe the blacks and the Mexicans will definitely do battle here big time this summer. I hear blacks tell each other how much they want to smash the Spics because they, the blacks, believe, justifiably so, that the prison staff are afraid to punish the Mexicans but throw the blacks in the shoe. I sure wish Tom Chittum's book, Civil War II, would come true. Life is becoming a living hell for working-class whites in this cesspool nation. Have you watched the latest episode on TV, Dancing with Negroes? I try not to. I mean, Dancing with the Stars. God damn the greedy, perverted, insane Southern rich Christians for using black slaves instead of temporary white indentured servants from Britain and Western Europe. Your friend and comrade. Thanks. Okay, well, that's the way it goes in these gulags, and that's what they are, just like Solzhenitsyn talked about, gulags. Because a lot of the stuff that goes on in American prisons is mental torture, psychological torture. We're in the, what Solzhenitsyn was talking about was mainly physical torture. Well, before you start thinking how bad you've got it, let's go back to the pessimist guide to history. 1863, deadly church fire in Santiago, Chile. On December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, a very special service was planned in the Jesuit Church of La Campanilla, Chile. A visiting papal representative from Rome apparently compared Santiago's fine 17th century church unfavorably with some in Rome, and the local priest now promised, quote, I will give him such an illumination as this world has never seen, unquote. He certainly did. The interior of the church was decorated with many yards of draped muslin, pasteboard, and paper. More than 20,000 colored oil lamps hung from the ceilings, so many that the church servants had to begin lighting them in the middle of the afternoon to be ready for the evening service. On this tragic evening, the church was packed with some 3,000 worshipers. Boy, that's a big church. A spark from one of the lamps set off a blaze near the altar, which spread instantly to the decorations, and from there to the roof. Priests quickly escaped through the sacristy door, which they had shut behind themselves. Worshippers, meanwhile, raced towards the main door, their only exit now, and in the panic many tripped and fell, others fell over them, and soon a living barricade of victims piled on one another, blocking the doors and trapping others inside. Some 2,500 people, mostly women, died in the tragedy. Well, I guess you should keep your women home. 1864, the Fort Pillow Massacre. There's several opinions on this particular so-called massacre. On April 12th, during the U.S. Civil War, Confederate forces led by General Nathan Bedford Forrest surrounded Fort Pillow near Memphis, Tennessee. As it happened, the Union garrison there was mostly made up of black soldiers. Naughty, naughty! Confederates had been angered by the use of blacks as soldiers and had no clear policy on whether to treat captured blacks as prisoners of war or as rebellious slaves. Well, the South used blacks too, and a lot more than they'd like to admit. And not just as, cooks and so forth. Following the fort's surrender, Confederates began a cold-blooded massacre of the 600 Union troops at Fort Pillow, about 400 of whom were black. Confederate troops fired point-blank into groups of soldiers with their arms raised, bayoneted them, and hacked them with sabers. Well, the North did the same thing in various times during the Civil War. Atrocities are committed by all sides in war. Those who ran were chased down and killed like animals. Wounded soldiers in the hospital were shot to death and the hospital burned. And even women and children at the fort were methodically slaughtered. Bodies of blacks, living and dead, were heaped in piles and set afire. Meanwhile, two black soldiers who had been buried alive managed to dig their way out and escape. More than 300 people, mostly blacks, died in the massacre, sparking an outrage in the North. Confederates later agreed to treat captured blacks as prisoners of war. The general was personally exonerated, however. He later became the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. How about that? Well, I'll tell you one way to stop this type of thing is don't have war. don't have civil wars. But the trouble is, it looks like one of these days there may be one here. You never know. 1864, Sand Creek Massacre. Some 1,200 Colorado militiamen attacked a Cheyenne Indian camp in Colorado, despite the fact that the Indians were then negotiating for peace. Some 400 Indians were slaughtered in the unprovoked attack on November 29. Another Indian massacre for which the United States military was so famous. Well, you see, we're a Christian nation. We don't like those non-Christians. Those non-Christian mongoloids, man. We're going to kill them. Yeah, that was what was behind most of the genocide and killing of big groups of people was religion. And, of course, the white man has used the Christian form of Judaism to do their killing. 1864, the Calcutta Cyclone. Nearly 300 vessels were moored in the busy port of Calcutta, India, on October 5th, and visitors thronged into the city for the opening day of a religious festival. Though the weather was stormy, there was no real indication of the disaster that was about to strike. A former cyclone just hours away was headed straight for the city. Yeah, well, God hates religious festivals, I guess. If there is a storm coming, go hide in a bar. Bars are hardly ever destroyed. And the storm hit so quickly, there was no chance to evacuate to safety farther inland. Suddenly, furious winds ripped trees out of the ground, smashed native Indian huts, and tore roofs off of the houses in British colonials. Crowded passenger trains tumbled off the tracks, and in the harbor, ships tore loose from their moorings and were wrecked in heavy sea. At 3 p.m., a 30-foot high tidal wave struck. I guess you'd call that a tsunami, crushing some 200 ships in the harbor before rolling into Calcutta, where it flooded most of the day and killed some 50,000 people. Another 30,000 people died after the storm as disease spread through the ruined city. Another washout in India. How about that? 1865, General Lyon burns at sea. The one-year-old General Lyon, a propeller-driven steamship, caught fire and sank on March 25th, taking some 400 passengers and crew to the bottom of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, an area once called the Graveyard of the Atlantic. Well, 1865, here's an interesting one, the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, the dictator, on the evening of April 14th, while attending a play at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., President Abraham Lincoln was fatally shot by John Wilkes Booth, a 26-year-old actor who had been serving as a Confederate Secret Service agent. Only 5 days earlier, the bloody four-year Civil War had finally come to an end with Robert E. Lee's surrender at Appomattox. The mood in Washington was jubilant, though Lincoln's joy must have been mixed with some anxiety. During the war, there had been rumors that the Confederate government planned to kidnap him, but since the Confederate surrender rendered that pointless, hostility to Lincoln now manifested itself in the form of death threats. On the night of Lincoln's assassination, 80 letters threatening his life lay on his desk. What Lincoln could not know, however, was that the vehemently pro-Southern John Wilkes Booth had already made two unsuccessful attempts to kidnap him, and now swore to avenge the crippled South by assassinating him and others in his cabinet. On the morning of April 14th, after seeing a notice in the newspaper that the President and Mrs. Lincoln would be attending the play that evening, Booth began preparing his treacherous plot. You know, they might have, with the circumstances being what they were, they should not have put that in the paper. At 6 p.m., after luring the stagehands into a tavern, Booth entered the deserted theater and made his way to the presidential box. He prepared a board to jam the door of the foyer outside. Outside the box, drilling a peephole in the box door to enable him to watch the president's movements. Luck was with Booth that evening. After Lincoln was seated, an unreliable bodyguard left his post outside the presidential box so that it was unguarded when Booth arrived shortly before 10 o'clock p.m. Booth slipped into the foyer and jammed the door shut with his board he had placed there earlier. Then, watching the president through the peephole, Booth waited for a specific scene in which he knew there would be only one actor on the stage. The moment came, and Booth pushed open the box door, fired one shot into the back of the president's head at point-blank range, and leaped to the stage 14 feet below. Although he broke his leg upon landing, he turned toward the audience, brandishing a dagger, and proclaimed, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus ever to tyrants." He then limped off the stage and made his way to the back door and escaped on a horse that was accomplice had ready. Well, I think he was a tyrant by all the things he did and how he enforced this mess on the South. However, the southern oligarchs helped it come speed up. The southern capitalists were really pig-headed about it, or they could have headed it off. The theater audience watched all this, and with great confusion, not until Mrs. Lincoln screamed, "He has killed the president," did anyone realize what had just happened. Lincoln's comatose body was carried to a house across the street, where he died at 7:22 p.m. the following 7:22 a.m. the following morning. Authorities chased Booth for days and finally cornered and fatally shot him in a burning barn near Bowling Green, Virginia, on April 26. Booth's accomplices, who not only helped him escape, but also attempted the unsuccessful assassination of Secretary of State Seward that same evening, were all caught and hanged. In the months and years following Lincoln's tragic death, speculations about the various sinister conspiracies abounded. It is certainly true that a number of factions had reasons for wanting Lincoln dead. While many in the South at the time may have wanted revenge, it has never been proven that Booth was acting at the behest of the Confederate government. It has also been suggested that Lincoln's enemies in the federal government, who resented his conciliatory attitude towards the defeated South, knew of the assassination plot and did nothing to stop it. Since Booth revealed nothing to interrogators before his death, the truth about such speculations will probably never be known. There will be much speculation in the same vein after the assassination of another president. Yeah, like Kennedy. How about that? As far as I'm concerned, it was a banker's plot and some of the top people in the government, and it was hatched in Canada. I read a lot about it, but I've forgotten a whole lot, too. Well, this is why you have to be always on guard when you're walking or jogging or riding a bicycle or driving a car. No matter what you're doing, you have to be aware all the time that you could be a victim very quickly of the untouchables. Carter Strange was jogging alone in the Five Points section of Columbia, South Carolina, when he fell victim to the latest example of sudden black attack syndrome. This is when gangs of young untouchables for no reason attacked and attempted to murder whites. Sorry. In this case, it was eight blacks. All but one are juveniles. Beat Strange nearly to death and left him for dead. Public officials once again refused to press hate crime charges, which rarely ever apply to white victims anyway unless they're gay and so forth. If the races had been reversed, one can bet the race hustlers and press would be out in force. The only reason we hear of this is LiveLeak.com. But the Fifth Circuit solicitor, Dan Johnson, said no evidence suggests the beating was racially motivated. Yet other people on the web are claiming other whites were attacked in the area, but not blacks. Well, we know what it is, and it's just going to lead to more and more hatred, and white lives matter more. Professor Walter E. Williams notes most racist assaults are committed by blacks. In many of these brutal attacks, the news media make no mention of the race of the perpetrators. If we were white racist gangs randomly attacking blacks, the mainstream media would have no hesitation in reporting the race of the perps. Well, just keep doing it. Just keep doing it, boys. The media. Our media, worse is better. The pot is boiling. The pot is boiling. Editors of the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune admitted to deliberately censoring information about black crime for political reasons. These racist attacks can at least in part be attributed to the black elite, who have a vested interest in racial paranoia and that includes a president who has spent years aligning with people who have promoted racial grievance and polarization, minority and the black crime. Let's see here. The only reason they found these animals was because the merchants in the area installed surveillance cameras everywhere to combat crime. The crime wave in the area. The seven black juveniles charged with attacking strange and have to stay in jail until trial. Oh, that's too bad. And 19-year-old Thyrene Henry had his bond set at $750,000. They have been charged with second-degree assault. Second-degree assault? That's attempted murder, of course. And battery by mob, common law robbery, and criminal conspiracy. Because most are juveniles, they will escape real jail time they deserve. This is when the families need to step in. It's never going to turn around until there's retribution, I'm telling you. Never. Police say Strange was jogging home just after midnight when the suspects approached him in a parking lot near Blossom Street and beat him up. Passerby found him a block away 2 hours later and called 911. Well, too bad he wasn't packing and shot him all dead. Strange had to have emergency brain surgery and facial reconstruction surgery after the violent attack and is making full recovery. I doubt that. My physical condition is amazing, said Strange. I mean, the condition I'm in right now is a miracle. Well, don't be self. Think about retribution, boy. The city of Columbia has approved an emergency 11 p.m. curfew around 5 points for minors under 17. It will last for 60 days. Boy, that would be good hunting ground. I'll tell you, just hang around in the corner after midnight with a hoodie and wait for them to come after you. I think the curfew is a great thing, said Strange. They just need to make sure that they enforce it. They're not going to enforce it. That's eyewash bullshit. There's already hedging on the part of the black chief of police in enforcing the curfew, because while nobody's saying it, it will be about blacks. Yeah. Well, like I say, I remember, I don't know, it was about 10, 12 years ago in L.A., there was a Jeepster or something like that went roaring through the black area, and guys jumped out of the car and blew away several blacks and disappeared. And nobody's ever been charged with that crime, which probably wasn't a crime. Told you before about in Saigon when certain people that really played the game were in charge. Every morning they would go out on the street and there'd be bodies laying all around. These were communists that were taken care of during the night. I think maybe they should import some Asians into that neighborhood. Asians seem to have more of a propensity to defend themselves all the way than whites. Of course, the schools have totally brainwashed these people into being nice guys and not offending anybody, not hurting anybody, and above all, never beat on a black person. So that's what happens. Now, this kid probably might have been a little more aware of the situation, but if he's in a mixed race neighborhood and he's jogging alone after midnight, he should have been armed. Absolutely. Probably if the cops had stopped him, they'd have taken him to jail for having a gun. Is it better tried by 12 than carried by 9 or 4 or 5? I forget how that goes.
I'm in a position to know, because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. The vote will be theirs. You'll have black mayors and black policemen the way they do in Chicago and New York already. Like as not, a black governor and black doctors to deliver your babies. If they find time, that is. And that's the way it'll be. The position to know. Like as the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South.